Let me just say a word, since I didn't say anything especially about it, because what it does, unless you've got a lot of time, I think is really make the job tough. We were stressing that you ought to be objective, if at all possible, the first time with verbs in it, without verbs. The basic idea being that as soon as you put a verb in, you put an action in, you're already in the objective stating some kind of means. And the objective really ought to be stated, you see, without the means, so that you don't get to the place where you run into difficulty. Specifically, for example, we picked one because it's not a bone of contention at all. There was something in there about saying that one of the objectives was to establish a publishing company for publishing church literature and so forth, and finding out that this already pinned down what you were going to do. If your objective certainly wasn't to establish the publishing house, your objective was to have Christian literature made available, and you may have done it in various ways. But that objective, really, if you want to be sure you have an objective and you don't have a means along with the end, you take a look and find if you've got very many verbs in it, you'll find out that you probably got some means immediately put in with the objective. That's what he was referring to. We had a lot of fun because they started to write up objectives. I suppose Dr. Grum wrote the first set for overall Senate. And as I recall, when he got through, he said to Walter, "Well, what do you think about that? It's the first attempt." And Walter said, "That's fine. I don't like one of them." He said, "You batted 1,000. I didn't like a one of them by the time they got through." One of the things is, Bill Hilmer says he remembers that on objectives that I will never forget in that meeting, is taking a series of walks at night. Well, we did it after just about every session, but up at Pierre Marquette Park, you have a very beautiful spot, and Dr. Behnken and Dr. Grum and Walter Guest and I would take walks talking about objectives and how to state them. This is part of my life that I'm sure I will never forget, seeing these men trying to work on the things that we were talking about in administration at that time. Today, we want to cover a few additional items. Yesterday, I said that I would start today talking about line and staff authority because I hadn't gotten around to it yesterday and people asked questions. So let me briefly go back to this chart up here and make a few comments about organization as a brief review of some of the things we said, talk about line and staff, and then get into some of the items I want to talk about today, which really tie back to this, so that I think it's a good point to start there. We indicated yesterday that we have various basic functions which have to be carried out in any organization. That functions such as these that we have here, at least these certainly as a minimum, would have to be carried out in every parish, that we would have all of these functions involved. We did it by going through the 6 functions that every business has, saying there's some necessary service functions such as we have in the trustees taking care of physical property and that type of thing. But there are also the functions of administration. Now, so far as the functions of administration are concerned, one of the reasons for proposing that we have a church council or board of directors or whatever we want to call it on top, and that council have the basic authority in the church given to it by the voters' assembly. In other words, that from the voters' assembly we go to the church council, is that I am proposing an organization of this kind as the place to do the overall planning, the overall work on organizing, the overall work of implementing the program, being sure it's all coordinated, giving the overall leadership to it and controlling it to be sure it's carried out according to plan. In other words, so far as the functions of administration are concerned, I'm proposing they be here in an overall sense in a central board. Then in turn, of course, planning for this particular phase of work, organizing and so forth, would be down here. But the overall planning in a central organization should get coordinated planning. If you have each one of these groups to frame and then just get to the place where they come together here to discuss what they're going to do, you know we're get overall planning, organizing, implementing, and controlling. So that to get these management functions, which are just as significant, you see, as the basic functions of the organization itself carried out, we've got to have a structure that does it. And using a board here to do it overall, then individual boards to do it, and of course each sub-board again doing it clear down to the man doing the final work, doing it for his particular function. Now in that connection, then a term which was asked about yesterday, which I had a brief notation here but skipped because of time, and that is, what do we mean by line functions, what do we mean by staff functions, and what significance do they have in administration? I suppose there's been as much controversy and as many pages filled on what are line functions, what are staff functions, how do you differentiate in the literature and business, as there have been in any of the most hotly contested theological disputes we've had. There's a tremendous amount of writing, and when all is said and done, I'm not so sure that we're really a good deal better off than we were before. What they were trying to do with this is to raise this question. Are there some functions which are so basic that these would be line functions, and the rest of them staff functions which would help the line? In other words, the idea is that a line function is directly involved, you see, in operation. A staff function is in there only to help the line, and that you'd actually have the lines of authority going from your central group through the line authority, and the staff people just out here giving help and advice. The difficulty you run into is to decide which ones of these things are so basic. And there's been a tremendous amount of writing, a tremendous amount of debate, and I think the issue has never been settled. My own reaction would be to say this. If you're going to differentiate between line and staff functions, we would say that line functions are those which are the most significant or most basic in carrying out the objectives of the organization. The staff functions are those which we consider to be necessary to help the people who are actually out here on the firing line carrying out the objectives. And this means, of course, we can still debate the thing. As I said yesterday, I would be inclined to say, except for public relations, that the Board of Trustees is really here pretty largely a service function. I call it service rather than a staff function. A service function to some of the others. Some people may say that physical facilities in good shape are just as important as anything else in the work of the church. This is basic, and if this is their point of view, I can't argue with them. You see, it always depends on where you start with what point of view as to where you put them. To a large extent, I think probably a good part of the debate is pretty strictly academic, that it doesn't really make too much difference what is involved, and as long as you get to the place where you get the proper relationship, and if you can tie them together here, I think this is appropriate. Now, let me say this. If somebody says, therefore, in the church council, you ought to put the line function, and if this is essentially a staff function, and if public relations is a staff function, most people would put that as staff, therefore, these people would not be involved up here, then I still wouldn't agree. In other words, as long as we get the proper relationship that these people are providing the kind of facilities that are needed to do the basic functions of the organization, and that these people are doing the same thing and publicizing all of the basic things that we're doing, then I don't think it really makes much difference whether we call them line or staff. In other words, I think this is a distinction which, if you could neatly make it, might well be worthwhile, but I don't think it can be made that neatly, so that I don't think we need really worry particularly about it in the work of the church. I wanted to discuss it briefly only because a lot of people talk about it. It's a generally used business term. I've heard people raise questions about it, and since it was specifically raised, I wanted to briefly mention it. Now, very briefly then, our two of the functions that we have, implementing and controlling. We're not going to talk about all of implementing by any means, because remember what we said, that implementing is really now assembling the men, the money, the materials into a going concern. This whole process now of actually putting these things together and then providing the leadership for this organization, actually administration here leading it as it's carrying out its functions, is an implementing. I want to discuss primarily the second part of it, and that is decision making briefly and leadership rather than the first part of it. This is not to say that the first part of it is not a very significant problem, and you have discussed it in other sessions, especially if we're talking about a new mission, we're talking about administration in various congregational or various synodical levels. We do have a real problem here of activating, assembling the right men, money, and so forth, but I'm not trying to downgrade the importance. I'm just saying that this is a thing which I think probably gets a lot more consideration than the others. And so on that basis, I would like to take the second phase of implementing. That is this whole matter of really directing the organization as it's going through all of the various functions it's carrying out, implementing in the sense here of management or administration, directing the activities in an organization. By directing, when we're talking about directing, we're talking about communication, we're talking about motivation, we're talking about decision-making and leadership. Let me say just a few things about them, because again, if we took any one of these topics, we could spend an hour or several hours, I suppose, spend a whole session just talking about one of these topics. I don't want to talk about communication in the sense of communication here really as the art or science of communication. You spent a lot of time talking about that in the seminary in various courses, and I certainly am not trying to talk about it here. Nor do I want to talk about motivation in the sense of going into what motivates an individual. I don't want to go in other words. In other words, I don't want to get technically involved in either communication or motivation. These are both large topics in themselves and extremely important. I just want to make a statement in passing, which I made the first day to reemphasize here again. I think we need some work done in the church on the basis of just how do we, in a Christian way, motivate people. I'm not talking now about the work of the Holy Ghost, but I'm talking about individuals working with other individuals. How do you motivate them to work with you in various activities? Because certainly when we talk about relationship of man to man, this is a situation where Christian principles clearly apply, and I don't think we can pick up what may have been developed by psychologists who do not particularly have Christian principles. I'm not saying they're unchristian by any means, the great majority, but they're certainly not Christian, and certainly even to the extent that they are, do not hold the position that we do. So that I think this needs some very careful consideration. But this I don't want to get into at this point. I just want to mention that because I have seen very frequently that we've picked up things about motivation from various psychologists and sociologists. I'm not always sure that we can just afford to lift them. I think this is a thing where, as Professor Danker said, maybe some of this pagan material needed to be baptized. I think maybe some of this does, because at least, let me say, it needs careful examination, because it didn't start with Christian principles and we're clearly dealing with them. But what I want to get into primarily in these topics is what kind of a overall organizational setup do we need here to make communication and motivation work effectively. The first thing I would like to talk about is back to a structure of relationships. And that is that so far as research is concerned today on what works most effectively in any organization, we would have this sort of situation that we often get to the place where we have groups at various levels that we really have overlapping groups working together. In other words, if we have a board of stewardship here, we don't have a chairman of the board of stewardship going in and saying, these are the decisions that I have made for the stewardship committee, or coming back and saying, the church council has made these decisions for stewardship, this is what you people are supposed to do. What we get down here is to have this group of people working together, planning with stewardship, and preliminary plans going back up here to the church council, which has representatives from all of these groups, developing plans now which each one of these people have been in on, you see, then going back here again to this particular group on a plan where originally they have had a place in setting the thing up, so that a member of this group is a member of this one. The overall decisions are made by a group up here, then they're implemented down here again, but this group has been in on it right from the beginning and said, these are the things we need to do, we think ought to be done in stewardship. We've carried it back up here. The overall thing has come out as an integrated, organized program for the congregation and then come back. In other words, I am clearly saying we do not today believe that an organization works best if you put one man on top of it, he turns around and tells the people in the layer underneath him, one man again, what to do, and they in turn tell people underneath them, but that you involve the group constantly as you go on through. It's for this reason that in answer to a question, I made the statement that a good part of the organization we have in our church with all of these various boards is really a very fortunate thing at the present time, because we've gotten the kind of organization we're tending to. If we can get the cooperation we need in central planning, we've really got the basic idea of group involvement already set up here. But in other words, the present thinking on administration, this is not just a matter of logic, but a matter of some of it of very careful research in numerous organizations, is that an organization works best if you don't have one man out here telling a group of men underneath him what to do, and then they in turn telling a group of people underneath them what to do, working from man to man, but working as a group, with each group being involved, in other words, overlapping groups. This group is involved in what's being done up here, and then this group in turn turns the thing back here, and this all works as group activity with representatives moving on up. So you see what I'm arguing for is a church council composed of church officers and also the people who are in each one of these various functional areas, working together with plans, suggestions for plans flowing from here up here, being put together in an overall plan, coming back down here so that all of these people have been involved right from the beginning. Communication works best when that happens, because all of the people here know what you're talking about. They've been in on it, been informed right from the beginning, and of course motivation works best because these people have had a hand in working out the plan, suggesting the sort of thing that you're going to do. I think one thing we'd have to say immediately, if this system is going to work, it means you need some degree of stability in each one of these groups. The reason being that if people are going to do this, they've got to get to know each other. They've got to get used to working together. So that if what you do is once a year you get to the place where you turn all the boards over, the thing isn't going to work. You're going to have to get to the place where you set up three-year terms or so, take a third of the people off each year or something of that kind, so that you get some stability if this whole process is going to work. In other words, it works no more in a church to turn over a whole group each year than it would in a business to get a whole new group of executives and expect that business to go anywhere. At times, under the guise of democratic principles, we decide that we have to completely re-elect each group each year. The net result is they don't get very far. They're frustrated, so when the year is over, they say, well, I'm mighty thankful I put in my year there, and out they go, and we just keep on being frustrated. You've got to get some stability to make this kind of an organizational setup work. Another thing, so far as the atmosphere is concerned, if this is going to work, people are going to have to feel that they're valued and respected. They're going to have to develop confidence and trust in each other. In other words, each one of these boards has to work together. It would be nice if I could make the statement that this is one place where the church never has to worry because everybody has confidence and trust in every other group and they automatically work together. You know, it isn't true. We run into problems there from time to time, just as we do anywhere else. But this will not work unless we've got confidence and trust. But if this group has originally suggested what has gone up here and been put into an integrated plan, may have been changed somewhat, so it's an overall congregational plan, there's communication there, then this confidence and trust ought to develop. They find out that these people are not just saying, look, this is what you fellas do, but we've modified this somewhat because of the overall plan of the congregation. We ought to work together much more effectively. Under operating characteristics, there are a few things that I would like to note there and stress. One of them is this: we have to have full communication. Everybody's got to know what everybody else is doing in a setup of this kind, and it has to be completely candid communication. You can't say, well, let's not tell them all of what we want to do because they may throw out some parts. Let's keep a few of them back here in our own private hip pocket. We have to have candid communication all the way through to know exactly what's going on. We also have to be sure that every part of the organization knows of any change that's taken place anywhere else. In other words, we can't say what happens over here is none of the business of these people over here. We've got to have full communication with all of them because we're trying to integrate this whole program into a working whole. We also have to be sure of another thing, and that is this, that the objectives that are actually being followed here, I'm not talking about what you may have written down, are in harmony with the overall objectives of the group. If we end up, as we do in some congregations, with the Board of Evangelism, which says we believe that this is the most significant thing in this whole congregation, and you know there are a lot of well-meaning people who would say this becomes more important than everything else, they may well get to the place where they don't coordinate their objectives with these others. In other words, if your objective is this total congregation of people worshiping and serving the true God, none of these can be put out and said this is more significant than the rest of them. They're all significant together, so that you have to have the whole thing coordinated, not have one group say ours is the most important, as we get some people doing from time to time. And it's completely understandable. We have a lot of people who work on the assumption that after all, bringing people to Christ is the most significant thing we can do. We want to bring as many souls to Christ as possible so they feel missions ought to come ahead of everything else. You don't have to look very far to find people who would take the synodical budget and double what missions gets and cut all the rest of them proportionately and decide we've done a better job. And if the Lord were coming for the second judgment in 10 years, this might well be true. But if we take the longer run point of view of a church not only bringing people to Christ but keeping them in Christ, it just isn't true. So what I'm pointing out here, we often get this conflict, especially with the people who are stressing missions, because they have become so thoroughly interested in missions that they don't always recognize that a lot of other things have to be done in a Christian congregation to bring people to Christ, to have them stay with Christ and worship and serve the true God. Another characteristic for organization of this kind is that we ought to have decentralization in decision making. We talked about that yesterday. We ought to get decisions made just as close to where the work is actually being done as possible. In other words, every decision that can be made down here should be made down here. We shouldn't have somebody centrally deciding, we'll make the decisions, we'll hand them on down. We ought to get as many decisions as possible made right down here with the work level. Now, you can understand, of course, that unless you do an overall job of planning, this can become anarchy. If what you do is decide, well, there's one thing Dalton said I like, and that's decentralization. You get decisions made down here. And you don't do the rest of it. You don't get the overall planning and organizing. You've got energy. These people are all making decisions willy-nilly, helter-skelter. You've got people all over the place, nobody coordinated, and it doesn't work. In other words, decentralization does not mean no central organization. Decentralization means that those decisions which can be made are being made right down here at the work level. We're not telling these people exactly how to do a job. We're all together on what they're to do, and they're deciding themselves how to do it. But we do have the whole thing tied in through the organization to achieve the primary objectives of the organization. This, of course, also means that if we're going to do that, we have to recognize that those things which cannot be done here on an individual basis do have to be sent higher up into the organization. No group down here in worship can decide exactly what the total worship program of the congregation ought to be. And if they want to decide this total worship program and how it fits in with the rest of it, this is not decentralization. This is getting this group, you see, moving way up here and setting up the overall top policy of the organization. So that if we're going to use decentralization, we also have to recognize the function of the central organization and recognize that there are some things that have to be done there. And when we talk about a group of churches, we've got to recognize again that even though we may have decentralization in each individual congregation supreme, we have to join together for things that we cannot do effectively as an individual congregation. And this means, again, that the individual congregation gives up part of its authority to join with a group of congregations in synod, in district, to do work of that kind. Let's move on then to decision-making and leadership. I don't know that I need say a great deal about decision-making. I talked about it briefly the first day, but I don't want to go back to it again, but indicating that essentially when we're talking about decision-making, we ought to be doing decision-making on the basis of analysis and evaluation. We ought really never make a decision until it is clear-cut what the objective is that we have in mind, where we're trying to go, how this whole thing fits into the overall program that we have. In other words, decision-making should be done on that basis. Now you're saying, well, aren't there problems which you don't decide that way? And my answer is that you really don't know what a problem is until you know what your objectives are. We have a lot of people who will decide what a problem is on the basis of some superficial manifestations of something being wrong. The real way to be sure that you've got the basic problem is, what is the objective of this particular activity? What are we trying to do? And then analyze why you didn't meet the objective. This analysis gives you the real problem, and then you get a solution which will bring you in line with it. Matter of fact, I think probably the one place where we fail, and I'm talking about people everywhere in administration more frequently than anything else, is that we end up by seeing a manifestation of a problem, and we immediately decide, well, here's a man of action, he's going to do something about it, so we get around here to taking care of the manifestations of the problem without really getting at the heart of it. To really get at a problem, you've got to ask, what is trying to be accomplished? What are the basic objectives? Then what's keeping us in this situation from meeting the objectives? With that kind of analysis, we get the problem, and then the decision, of course, is one of taking action to get us back in line with the objectives. This is a tough thing to do. It's a mighty tough thing to stop yourself and to say, let's find out just why do we have a problem? What are we trying to accomplish? Let's just stop and back up here. You'll periodically find somebody doing that, and some of the rest of them will say, well, let's forget about all this. We got a problem to solve right now. We got to get rid of it right now. Instead of solving the problem, you've made it worse because you haven't really gotten around to asking what the real problem is. You really, if you stop to think about it, in a very real sense, you never have a problem unless you have a specific thing you're trying to achieve. It's hard to have a problem unless you're going somewhere. If you're not going anywhere, you don't have a problem. You might have a minor irritation on them, but you can't have a problem. You've got to be going somewhere to really have a problem. You have a problem when you've gotten some difficulties in reaching objectives, so you ought to go back and find out what the objectives are. Basically, let me spend a little bit of time then discussing this matter of leadership. We talk about leadership a good deal. Let me first make an attempt to indicate what I think is really involved in leadership. In other words, we look at a man and we say he's a good leader. Basically, what does he do? It's pretty clear-cut that one of the characteristics of good leadership is not that here's a man who is always out here pushing with a dynamic personality. We've got some leaders who are more or less in the background. You don't particularly think about them as people who are always out here in the forefront. And still, they're doing a very effective job. If you ask who really influences what's going on here, who's really the man who's the real leader behind it, you'd say, there's the man. And he might not have the kind of personality you would ordinarily think about in the way of leadership at all. What are the qualities, really, of an effective leader? What is it that they're doing? One of the things I think that happens is this. A leader in any organization is a man who has vision. In other words, who can see ahead in what's happening here in an organization and in this environment and can tell what the significance of these developments is for the organization as a whole. In other words, here's a man who looks ahead, who sees ahead, who knows, first of all, knows his organization thoroughly. He knows what's happening in his environment. He sees the implications of this thing. Obviously, you can't lead in the past. The leader's got to be a man who is here bringing people together for action in the future. And this is a fellow who foresees better than other people what's going on. In other words, he understands the organization. He understands its environment. He sees what changes are taking place. He sees the implications for the organization, and then he has the organization take action, you see, which will bring them to their goal in line with this. Some people do this more or less intuitively. Some people do it by a very conscious study of what's involved. And let me say this. This is one of the things, by and large, with which people are not born. We keep saying, what are we going to do? This fellow isn't a leader. Leaders are born. What are you going to do with it? There are some people, I suppose, who have such a personality that they're afraid to talk with anybody and that it'd be almost impossible for them to be a leader. But by and large, if a man is intelligent and has a reasonable personality for getting along with people, he can develop the qualities of leadership. Some people have more or less fallen into this pattern. Some people have the kind of personality and the kind of interest which will get them more easily. But this is not a thing you're born with. This is a thing which you can develop. This kind of vision we're talking about here is kind of definitely have to work at and is something that can be learned. Another thing is this, that a leader is a man also who can see ahead what an organization ought to look like 1 year, 5 years, 10 years in the future, what any group ought to look like if it's going to adapt to these changes and meet its environment. In other words, he has a mental picture of what he is trying to achieve, you see, a mental picture of where this group ought to be before you ever get there. You will have some people say when somebody else has pointed this thing out, I just can't visualize that at all. Here's one man that says, wait a minute, I'll draw it up on the blackboard for you. In his mind, he's completely conceptualized this thing and he sees ahead. This is one of the qualities of leadership. You can't get people to go along unless you know where they're going to go in the future. You've got to do it. And again, this is something you can learn. You don't just get to the place where you literally dream up what this organization is going to look like. This is a mental process where you sit down, take all of the things that are going to happen, you work these things out mentally and decide what this picture is going to look like. Another thing, a leader now is a man who initiates action. In other words, he's the fellow who's up here, who's the spark plug, who initiates the activity to move the organization in this direction. And then lastly, he's the fellow who is able to get cooperation, give people guidance so that they cooperate in the development of this particular situation. These essentially, I think, are the things which a leader does. Now, this doesn't mean that the leader is a man who's up here giving out orders. You may have a leader. As a matter of fact, in quite a few groups, you may find that the real leader in a group doesn't even happen to be the man who's the chairman. You may have a congregational setup in which the real leader is a man with this vision, with the man who's always out here pushing for action. He may not be the congregational chairman. You may get some jealousy when the chairman thinks he ought to be doing this. Actually, if you all recognize that it makes very little difference who gets the credit for a job, you ought to be willing to accept the leader even if he isn't the man who's here as chairman.
The man who's the chairman of the platform committee of the Republican convention has a sign in his office, which I think is a good one, for all of us in Churchway. It's amazing how much you can get done if you don't care who gets the credit for it. And you see what happens. If we've got an effective leader who doesn't happen to be very effective before a group, and we've got a chairman who's willing to work with him. We may well utilize the activities of both people. We've got some people who are very effective at leading the discussion and so forth, but don't have this ability of vision at all. Matter of fact, I think you would find very frequently in the history of the world when you've had real effective leadership, you've had an outgoing personality who somewhere behind him, you had a man who didn't have quite that personality, but he had this gift of vision of conceptualizing what was going to happen, getting all these friends, and the two work together. And when you can get two people like that working together, you've got a mighty good combination. Obviously, if you can get them in one man, it's even better. But the Lord, unfortunately, didn't make men that way very often. They very seldom come together in one man on that basis. Now, the other thing that you can see immediately is this. We don't have this one man. Leadership can be a matter, really, of using the group to get all of these various things. And I dare say that as the world becomes more complex, we're finding that really the only way in which you can do all of these things, you can see all of these implications, is to have really a group in which the man is nothing but the chairman of the group, and all of these various concepts are developed here in a group process, and then we work together in a group in this way. It's for that reason that we're suggesting that all of these people who know their field best be together here in this overall group to really conceptualize where we're going and to take the initiative and do it as a group process. Now, so far as the individual is concerned, there will still be somebody here as chairman. I put down the topic here of developing your leadership pattern. It doesn't mean that you can't have a wide range of degree of individual initiative which this man exercises and still be an effective leader. I don't think in any church group you would expect a leadership pattern as a regular thing in which you have one man who pretty likely tells the rest of the people what to do. And still, I will have to admit that there are occasionally pretty authoritarian leaders who are quite good. As a matter of fact, sometimes quite accepted by the group. You're likely to find a fellow who's listened to all of this discussion, and then he's got the unique ability of putting this whole thing together, putting it in words that everybody says, well, this we agree with. They're just telling people this is what we're going to do, and they all go along. Ordinarily, I wouldn't ask for that. This takes a real skill on the part of this person. I think our best leadership pattern would be one here in which it's oriented to the subordinates. You're not telling these people. You're working with them. You're acting really as the chairman to get their group decisions and develop that kind of leadership pattern. But the main reason I'm arguing for a pattern is this. I don't think any group works effectively if at one time the man comes in and says, I want you people to work it out. The next time in a similar problem, he says, I decided to do this. He's got the group constantly confused. They're frustrated. They don't know what they're going to do. And I think this becomes extremely important for a pastor in his position, since he is really involved in this whole activity and has got one of the toughest jobs in administration. He's not the chief administrator except in a mission congregation. He's a resource person for all of these groups. He's got to be a leader behind the scenes, you see, in all of this. I think it becomes extremely important that he develop a rational leadership pattern. That sometimes he doesn't say, you people work it out, and then without thinking about it, and maybe other times when he says, this is what I think we ought to do, but not get them confused. They say, we really don't know how in the world to work with our pastor. Sometimes we know exactly what he wants, and sometimes we never can find out what he wants. You ought to consciously develop a leadership pattern, and when you depart from it, you may very decidedly decide, in this group, I want these fellows to work it out because this is going to be a good experience here in development of Christian faith, and let them work it out, that you ought to know consciously you're doing it in that particular situation. Then, a few things about controlling, since time is getting away. We pointed out when we first talked about controlling, this is a function which creates some difficulties in the minds of a lot of people, because they're not quite ready to say that we want any one person or any one group to have control over another group. And keep in mind, of course, in the sense in which we're using controlling, this really is not what we have in mind. We want to be sure that our plans as we have made them are being carried out. Now, another thing to recognize when we talk about control is this. You can't control the past, pretty obviously. I say that because frequently we may get around to the place where we think we have pretty effective control and all we're doing is looking at past results and seeing how well they work. What you're doing there is saying we're going to take a look at what happened in the past to see if we can assure this thing not happening again in the future. And I suppose in a very real sense, if your time period is short enough, this is always true because you can't do a thing about this thing as it's happening currently. But what we want to be sure of is that we are working out so that we assure in as far as is humanly possible that the plans we've made are being carried out. This, of course, means that a control system has to be related to planning and has to be built right into a planning system. In other words, if we set up a series of plans, we've got to develop at the same time a system of control to be sure that those plans are being carried out. We can't just ignore this matter of control, nor can we get all through and say, now how are we going to control this thing? As we're planning this thing, as we're organizing, we've got to get up a system of control. If we're going to have such a system, there are several things which are necessary if it's going to work effectively. One thing is this. We've got to have a way of reporting any deviations from our plans expeditiously. We've got to know when our plans are not being carried out. It doesn't do us any good to know them at the end of a quarter or anything of that kind. We've got to have a method here of immediately knowing when plans aren't being carried out. At the same time, we've got to balance that with a plan that's economical enough that we don't spend so much time and money on controlling that we haven't got any time for getting anything else done. I don't think this is particularly a problem in most church groups, since I think we do very little controlling anyway. But there are times when people in a control section in business become so enthusiastic about control that they get to the place where they spend more money controlling than what you ever did with any good with the whole process. Another thing about a control system is that it has to be understandable. There's no use having a control system which people don't understand. And in this sense, I'm not only talking about understanding the words, I'm talking about understanding what the whole purpose is of control and what you're trying to do. This is one area in which I think untold harm has been done in various organizations, because you've got a control system, people don't understand what you're trying to do with it. And on that basis, this leads to all kinds of reactions against the people who are higher up in the organization, because they think they're constantly trying to put pressure on them, they're constantly trying to get them to do something which isn't reasonable, something of that kind. A lot of conflict has come right here in this whole matter of control. We have to have a system which is understandable and which is understood by the people working in the organization. And then lastly, we have to have a system which is going to assure corrective action. In other words, there's no use knowing that we're deviating. We've got to assure corrective action. Now, if you ask how do we go about doing this, this is still one of them that has an awful lot of difficulty with it. There are some things we can control pretty effectively in an organization if we're dealing with physical activities and with machinery, that type of thing. But when we start talking about human beings, we still have a tremendous problem of how you actually go about assuring plans being carried out. And some people have gone so far as to say that maybe controlling oughtn't to even be a step here, except the controlling ought to be like assembling materials and so forth. The controlling would involve physical things. So we set up various controls such as thermometers, thermostats, that kind of thing, but that you don't really try to control people, that this whole section ought to be moved back and put under leadership, but really all you've got is communication and motivation. And this may well be pretty largely true. I think there are some things in control that are worthwhile, but as I've indicated, this is one that creates some real problems. We recognize that we have to assure the carrying out of plans. How do we do it? Now, let me give you at least a few suggestions here on control and then point out that, as I've indicated, a good part of it goes back to communication and motivation. Because keep in mind, you can't really force a human being to do anything you want to unless you hypnotize him or drug him or something of that kind. He does it because he voluntarily wants to go along. If you're going to have effective control, if you're going to assure that your plans are carried out, one of the things that's necessary is that you establish standards of what you really expect to be done. In other words, you can't get to the place where one of the functions over here, let's say we give the board of elders the function of increasing church attendance. And if all we say is that we want to increase church attendance and we don't go any further than that, it is pretty hard to have any control. In other words, we can't assure the carrying out of plans. We don't even know, you see, when the plans aren't being carried out. Because what we're saying is here that what we're trying to do is to increase church attendance. If we're going to actually make this thing effective, we're going to have to get around here to talking about some standards. One of the obvious ones, of course, might be to say that if we have 40% of the communicant members here in church on Sundays, the standards we're going to set is that over the next year we intend to raise this to 50, and we think we ought to be one-fourth of the way there each quarter of the year. Now, this still gets to be mighty arbitrary, but at least we don't look at the thing at the end of the first quarter and say either doing it or just forget about it. Frequently, we just assign this job until we've got to do something about church attendance. If we want to really do something about church attendance, we set up a very detailed plan of what we're going to do, and then we set up standards for the kinds of results which we want. Now, your results may well not be just a matter of saying, okay, fine, we want to raise this percentage from 40 to 50 or from 50 to 60. Your standard may be one of saying, we want to be sure that those people whose church attendance has been very negligent, let's say those people who haven't attended church more than 10 times during the last year, will significantly increase their church attendance. We'd like to get to the place where those people are going to come twice as often as they came last year. Or let's say those people are going to be here at least half of the Sundays. We need some specific thing. In other words, we may get an overall percentage, we may go down to the individual soul accounting and say we want to bring new people into regular church attendance who weren't here. And then, of course, our standards become pretty clear-cut. We've had 100 communicants who attended church last year less than 10 times. During the first quarter of this year, of these 100, 5 have been here every Sunday, 5 have been here so many Sundays, and so on down the line. Now, I know that we, in most cases, don't get anywhere near doing this, but if we're really going to assure that what we're trying to do here is carried out, then we've got to go back here in this overall board and get reports and consider them and decide that if we end up here and we find out of all these people who were not attending church regularly, we've made practically no impact, and we better do a pretty serious job of reviewing our plans in that particular area, you see. But we've got to have some very definite standards. I'll go back over into the area of stewardship, and let's say take stewardship of time. What we want to do again, we've got a record of all of the people in our congregation, and we find out that here is a very large group, let's say a third of them, who spend no time in any church activity other than, let's say, coming to church on Sunday. What we want to do is to set up a standard that we want to get to the place where next year we don't get the whole third active, but let's say our standard is to get a one-third of this inactive group into some church organization. Then we're again going to have to use our control in getting reports on how effectively we've worked with these particular people. As long as we stay in these broad generalizations that we're going to do this, we set up a general plan, we go through the motions, we don't go back and check the thing, we don't recheck it, we're still not doing effective administration. You've got a real problem in human relations, too, when you do this. A lot of this is frustrating. It may well be by the time the Board of Stewardship gets all through, they've got their best plans to go through their whole campaign, and that result is they haven't got much of anything. Then when you turn around and you go back up here to the council and report this situation, and they say we're trying to control here in terms of the results, you may get some people who worked very hard unhappy. But if they understand that after all, we've been responsible for making the plan, so have these people. They're in on this whole procedure. We go back here and this thing hasn't worked, or it has worked, or here are the areas in which it hasn't worked, we know exactly where we're going. We don't just talk about getting people more active. We've got to talk about which groups are totally inactive, the people who have been only very inactive, the people who are active. It may well be in a campaign all we've done is to get to the place where the people who are already active are doing a few more things, and we haven't really solved the basic problem we set out. So we've got to have specific standards, and then we've got to be able to go back and appraise in terms of those standards. There are some areas in which we have to get extremely specific. Let me just take one of them that in most cases you're all involved. I hope you are, at least. Maybe you're not. And that's having a secretary. You need standards for secretaries. In other words, what kind of letter are you willing to send out? Just what do you expect a good letter to look like? This is me, you have to write it out for, but you can tell her when you're working with things, this is the kind of letter that I think is appropriate to come out here, this isn't. You need some very specific standards as to what is going to happen. When you get into jobs of that kind, there are standards that have been worked out. I mean, for other jobs in business, of course, in some detail. But we've got to have standards. I suppose the place where we have the poorest standards is for janitors. Just what do we actually mean? We hire the man and we say, it's your job to keep the building clean. Well, what does clean mean? We turned this job in Concordia Kirkwood over to the principal of our school, and he's developed some standards. This is clean means that this is done once a week, this is done once a day, this is done twice a day, this is done this way, this is the kind of wax you use, this is what's polished, and so forth. This takes time. Do you think the janitors rebelled? They're happy with it. They know now exactly what we expect. And we're back to where one man tells them what to do and keeps the overall thing in shape. But we've got to get to the place where we set up these standards. We don't do it for paid employees. We've got that situation. Somebody's been asking, who sets up the standards for the pastor? I suppose the Lord set him up himself pretty definitely, and I guess you ought to evaluate yourself, and I'm sure you do periodically in line with it. But we need standards. There isn't any question about it. I guess the Apostle Paul set him up pretty definitely. But even there, the pastor may, in administration in another area, set up standards for himself. And in some congregations, you will get to the place where the pastor reports to the Board of Elders on what he is doing, what he is attempting to do, his work with people who haven't attended communion, has become lax, and so forth. In other words, not just a general report, I'm working with them, but specifically, I'm working with these people haven't any success here, and so on down the line. But we've got to get in terms of our thinking to thinking in terms of standards. We don't like to do it, but as long as this stays general, we're still not getting anywhere. Then, of course, we have to appraise our performance in terms of the standards. This ought to be done by each individual group here, and then, of course, found to be done up here. We're likely to appraise our performance primarily in one way. We appraise our performance periodically in monetary terms. I would say most congregations have some control over money. They'll have a budget, and they'll get to the place where they'll have some control to be sure that things are not spent which aren't in the budget, and they'll report on how well they've done in terms of the budget. But since the function of the church is not to make budgets and the reports that we kept them, but it's something much more basic than that, we ought to be controlling in terms of the work to be done, reporting in terms of the work to be done, appraising in terms of the work to be done, and only, as a very insignificant part of that, reporting in terms of the budget. We frequently find people coming out and saying with pride, we made our budget last year. You may well have achieved the budget and missed the basic objective of your parish. This is not only true in churches, this is frequently true in business. A man will be so interested in making the budget that if he has an opportunity to do something which will cost somewhat more money and go above the budget, a lot of people will say, it'll look far better if we just made the budget or exceeded it, rather than go ahead and then have to explain that we really did something here that was more worthwhile. We want to be awfully sure that this budget doesn't become anything more than a tool. And this becomes thinking that's rather dangerous, because this is a constant problem in business, and a lot of businessmen in the congregations are doing the same area. As a matter of fact, the thing has gotten so bad in business that the word controller, C-O-M-P-T-R-O-L-L-E-R, which only means counter, you just keep the count of things, has even been spelled controller, which means he controls, and you get into constant problems because he doesn't really control anything except the records here in a well-organized organization. And then you get a fellow who believes he ought to do this in business, and then he gets around to the thing in the congregation, and we can get the financial area completely out of its basic importance. Now, we're saying then that so far as control is concerned, it ought to be done by constant review of all of these various, by all of the various boards who work underneath them, review by the central board regularly for the things that are being done here. Done in financial terms only lastly, but done in terms of jobs. And then, of course, the last step is immediately to correct deviations, and you can see what that means. It means replanning. Maybe the organization is wrong. You go through the whole procedure to decide when you haven't done it what you ought to do to redo this whole procedure as you're going through. Well, that is a rather general picture of what's involved here. We have about 5 minutes. Let me answer questions if you have them at this stage. Yes, sir.
Thank you. thing that's concerning us and that we want to work on is that we have such a small percentage here, and we intend next year we feel that this ought to be one of the projects carried out here. I would keep the board informed as you go along, and then I would not go to them at the time you're getting ready to draw up the plan for the next year with anything. If they brought out the plan, which then is to be integrated with the other plan. Now you can see what happens. If this is the only board that's signing, there's nothing to integrate it with. You're having a peculiar situation, so if you get one or two active boards and they've got plans in the left end, you really can't do the overall function. But if you've got an overall plan, how you see, what really should have preceded this whole thing is that the church council ought to be talking about what their objectives are and what, in a general way, they think they ought to be doing for the next year. This probably should be the first step. Then you go back over here and decide in the individual areas what this means and bring up your suggestions and put the thing back together. But let me say this, as a practical thing, start where it starts. I mean, don't say, let's wait till we get all the machinery going. Start where it starts. But the idea would be for this group to be discussing the overall objectives, working on where they're going this week, and then having the various groups to put these things together and where they're going more broadly. Yes? Yeah. Would elect the church council. The church council ought to go to the voting body, which is overall program, tell them what they're going to do. If there is any variation, disagreement, I would go back to the voting body and with the alternative plan. I think in most cases, the voting body is not going to go that far. But we can't work out details of these things in the voting body. What you can do, though, is help present the voting body with a final plan. I would present the voting body with a detailed plan for consideration and evaluation. And then on the basis of the reactions you get back, go back and say, we misjudge what kind of a plan will be effective with this particular group of people at this time. We've modified it to make it work for the rest of the group. Now, the final is already left there, but they're not going to do the work of setting up the plan. You're going to have to do it. But I would certainly adopt into the thinking of the other defendants. Occasionally somebody tries to go through an ideal one and away we go and get all kinds of trouble. You can see far better to take a stroll and get what the voters will do and then next time have a few more things to do. I just got that completely yesterday, so I'm going to go for it. I used to feel the number six conference for example, and I never called kind of much. We have discussion that then we could draw the all the other boards in the whole district of them and together then.
No. I would set up a general plan up here. The individual boards work up the details in their particular areas. You see, I'm even suggesting that these individual boards have suggested what in an overall plan it means in their area and the whole thing is coordinated. So what I am suggesting is this. Since you want not just these boards, but the total congregation in it, I think you've got to take this plan in some detail when you've worked it out to the total congregation meeting. And then if you find there are parts of it which meet with very vigorous opposition, then you may get to the place where you say, okay, what we want is the best possible plan, not per se, there isn't such a thing, the best plan for this group of people at this time. And you say, we misjudged them, we're going to have to go back and modify it to get the best plan for this group at this time. In other words, I don't think when we're dealing with human beings, there is such a thing as the best plan. There is the most workable, the most practicable plan for this group of people at this particular time. Since you want all these people in on the thing, supporting it, you've got to go to them. And there, after all, it's no question about it. Because we've set...